Good morning, everybody. I'm George Selgin, director of the Cato Institute's Center for Monetary and Financial Alternatives, and I'm very pleased to welcome all of you to today's discussion of the recently released report of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau Task Force. I also want to make sure that you take advantage of our discussion to ask us questions. I'll be speaking for about half an hour, maybe a little bit longer. During that time, you can use the place you're streaming this video chat on to ask questions, and we'll try to get to those at the end of our program. Besides being the head of the CFPB task force, Todd is George Mason University Foundation Professor of Law at George Mason University Law School, and he's also the former executive director of that school's Law and Economics Center. And as if that's not enough, he's also a Cato CMFA senior fellow. Welcome, Todd.
It's great to be here.
Are you there, Todd? Great.
Yes, can you hear me?
It's just shy. Yes, I can. It's just shy of a month since the task force released its report. So we're very, very pleased to have you with us today to publicly discuss it for the first time. We mainly want to focus on the report's recommendations, of course. But before going into those, I thought perhaps you could tell us a little bit more about the task force itself, including the members that make it up. How were they chosen, and what interest groups or areas of expertise do they represent?
Well, thanks, George. First, I want to thank Director Kathy Kraninger for her vision in deciding to do this task force and selecting me, giving me the honor of chairing it. It was a great treat and a real honor. We were commissioned by Director Kraninger to provide a report. We were chosen last January 2020, and we basically had three objectives, which is the first she asked us to do was to provide an objective and independent assessment and provide a consensus report of the current state of the consumer financial system and the like. Second, she asked us to provide recommendations as to how to improve and strengthen consumer financial laws. And third, she asked, perhaps most daunting, she asked us to do it within 1 year after setting it up. And so we were pulled together in January 2020. And January 5th of this year, we reported back. There were five members, myself as chair, Tom Durkin, who was a former economist at the Fed, Howard Beals, who was the former head of the Consumer Protection Bureau at the Federal Trade Commission, Bill McLeod, who was also a former head of the Consumer Protection Bureau at the Federal Trade Commission, and Gene Noonan, who is both was both the first consumer finance financial protection lawyer at the FTC, and later was the general counsel of the Farm Credit Bureau, and has had a very distinguished career in private practice. So we had an unusually rich array of different experiences and backgrounds, from economists to lawyers to a lawyer economist and the like, and it just turned out to be a really great team to work together with highly complementary skills.
Terrific. Well, thanks for that. Let's go ahead and go into the report, Todd. For those of you listening who don't know, this is a very substantial document. There's actually two documents. One is a 900-page one of investigative findings. And then there is a separate 100-page document that actually summarizes the task force's recommendations. I have that in front of me. I ought to confess, I've only read the whole second, shorter document, still working my way through the other 100 pages. But I want to focus, of course, for that reason, but also because I think it's what people care about, on the recommendation part of the task force report. But first, I want to ask you, Todd, what's the point of that other 900-page document? It reminds me a little bit. It reminds me a little bit of those high school assignments where the teacher said that besides answering the questions, you have to show your work. So I always assumed, I always assume when the teachers did that is so we wouldn't cheat, right? So is that why you have another 900 pages? Are you trying to show people that you didn't cheat? What's that all about?
Partly it is to show our work, George, which is that we have 102 recommendations, concrete recommendations. But one of the things to keep in mind is this is a document we were writing not for this year or next year or for the next 5 years, but something looking 10 or 20 years out. And so we really wrote the big report, the big first part, for two reasons, which was first to explain all the background reasoning to the recommendations so that people could see where they came from and basically see where we arrived at. But the second thing is to go beyond just the immediate issues of the day, which is what the recommendations are all about, and think about, sort of lay out a way of thinking about consumer financial protection over the long run, which is new issues are going to arise, not just the 102 recommendations we make, but new issues are going to arise over time. And we wanted to create a body, sort of a capital stock of knowledge that people could repeal back to, that they could look to come up with a framework for thinking about new issues as they arise. Because we're in a real state of flux right now with the consumer financial system, with technology and innovation and everything else. And so we thought it was important to provide a larger framework and not just immediate answers.
Okay, great. Well, so let's go on to those recommendations that come out of that framework. One of the first in the report is that, and I quote now, the Bureau, Congress, and other federal and state regulators should exercise caution in restricting the use of non-financial alternative data. It seems kind of hard to argue against exercising caution, of course, but just what sort of alternative data is this referring to? And why would regulators want to restrict its use? And finally, of course, why does the task force think that they need to be cautious about it?
Well, George, I think a centerpiece of the whole report, and I know a passion of mine as well as all of my fellow task force members, more than anything else, is financial inclusion, which is we have a remarkable consumer finance system that has developed in this country over the past several decades, really since the 70s. And it actually works really well for middle class Americans. Yet we have, through credit cards, mortgages, all that sort of stuff, sure there are problems, but it's really sort of a marvel of development and choice and competition. And a particular concern of ours was the question of financial inclusion, which is making sure we have a financial system that works for everybody, that works for people who have been around the margins. And a lot of those people have gained access, lower income people, immigrants, minorities, younger people have gained a lot more access than they had in the past. But this still remains a big sticking point, an issue that we really care about. And this runs through the whole report, whether it's our call for more research on how to improve access by rural communities, how to improve access for formerly incarcerated individuals who face real problems getting access to the financial system after they get out and the like, or the points that you talked to, which is alternative data, which is we've got a relatively hidebound system today through the consumer through the reporting, CIS credit reporting agencies and the like, which is works really well for most people. But there are a lot of people who don't have rich data credit files. The CFPB has said that there are tens of millions of people who have thin files or no files. And so I think it's a wide recognition that looking at new forms of data, such as cash flow data, such as paying utility bills and the like, can be a way of increasing financial inclusion and a way of increasing the accuracy of the risk-based pricing system. And a lot of the concerns are not well articulated, and they rest, I think, on some notions of sort of what is legitimate, what's illegitimate. And one of the points we make is that this is changing over time. It's very much in flux what people think about their information being used. And people have, and especially younger generations now are becoming more savvy and more careful about how their information is used. And a lot of the systems that are in place block access to things like cell phone payments, utility bills, and those sorts of data. And we wanted to try to create a playing field where those sorts of bills could be better, more part of somebody's file.
So the idea, Todd, is that that when people don't have a credit history of the kind that's usually considered adequate to justify, say, a bank making them a loan, that some other forms of information that isn't usually collected could be a substitute. But of course, it could work the other way, right? If we let financial firms gather other information, they could also use it as a reason to justify or basis for justifying excluding people from loans. Your proposal presumably is trying to find a happy medium between those possibilities. Is that right?
That's exactly right, George, which is one of the things we state again and again and again in the report, is that obviously we should enforce all non-discrimination laws and the like very rigorously and carefully. And so improper use of that data is something that we strongly object to, but you put your finger on the point here, which is that that there are a lot of people who don't have credit cards, for example, when they're younger, but they do have cell phones, they do have cash flow, they do have an ability to show their ability to pay their bills, and there's always the possibility that there is some aspect that using information that allows some people to get access to credit they otherwise wouldn't, or to get a lower rate than they wouldn't, means also that some people won't be a worse risk than they might appear at first glance. But information is the coin of the realm when it comes to financial services. And over the long run, our assessment is that more information, more accurate information in the system will end up making the system more efficient, and in the long run will increase financial inclusion for everybody.
I want to turn to some more recommendations specifically related to financial inclusion in the report. But first, I want to step back to a broader issue. The report puts a lot of emphasis on the CFPB's, mandate to ensure competition in markets, unquote, as one of several means for protecting consumers. So with that in mind, another of the report's recommendations is that the CFPB takes steps to make it easier for people to take their business from one bank to another. And the report compares the steps that ought to be taken or that can be taken to the ones regulators took in the past to facilitate competition among telephone service providers. So can you expand on this? I mean, after all, the banking industry isn't exactly like the old AT&T. So what's the problem here? What makes it hard for somebody to switch bank accounts? It doesn't seem that way to me. Is this something that particularly affects poor people? What's the story?
I think it affects everybody. So the way we come at this in the report, George, is one thing we know is that people aren't usually satisfied with their credit cards. When the Federal Reserve does studies of people's credit card ownership, they're very happy with their credit cards. And the reason is, it's really, people report, it's really easy to switch your credit card if you don't like your credit card provider. If you think they're socking you with a fee you don't need, you can, or don't deserve, you can cancel your card and move on to somebody else, which creates a real discipline effect. What we know is that that people change their bank accounts a lot less often than they do, say, with credit cards or prepaid cards, which also affects, obviously, their debit cards. Now, it could be we suggest it could be that people are just really, really, really happy with their bank accounts much more than they are with their credit card providers. But it could also be that bank accounts raise particular challenges for people to be able to switch their bank accounts, which attenuates the competitive pressures. And so, for example, one of the issues is you've got this problem of sort of trailing payments, which is, if you have automatic payments, for example, if you want to switch from bank A to bank B, for a while, you might end up having to maintain two bank accounts to make sure that all of your payments at bank A actually go through before you can switch to bank B. That's obviously going to be a tax on switching bank accounts, especially for lower income people. I switched bank accounts a few years ago, and I have to say it was a real hassle to try to do it. And so the analogy here isn't so much the old AT&T, it's to cell phone providers. And what we had in mind potentially was the idea of now you can switch your carrier and still keep your same cell phone. You can switch and cell phone number so that your number can move with you wherever you where you go. Other countries have come up with these open banking regimes that make this possible. Certainly technology has developed, such companies such as Plaid and the like, which have kind of stepped into this breach to try to provide ways for consumers to find out whether their money's making its maximum yield, to be able to get information, switch accounts, that sort of thing. I think to some extent that obviously that's useful. It serves a consumer function, but there may also be ways in which we can more directly facilitate competition in bank accounts so that people don't have as high of a switching cost. And that's what we're getting at, is at least make it easier, reduce those frictions to switch among different banks.
The report also recommends steps that would simplify or unify state licensing laws to, and again, I quote, make it difficult for that, sorry, to simplify laws that make it difficult for non-bank financial service providers to expand their business across state lines. So tell us a little more about the issue here, Todd, and the solutions that the report recommends.
Well, one of the big obstacles right now to innovation and inclusion, we think in the consumer financial system, is this web of state licensing laws, whether it's mortgage brokers, whether it's different personal finance companies and the like. And it's not really clear in a lot of cases what function they're actually serving in terms of helping consumers, as opposed to simply protecting incumbents. And writing the report during the pandemic turned out to be this terrible pandemic turned out to be a very interesting experience for us, which is that the report really has three main features. First, inclusion that we talked about. Second was looking at consumer financial protection through the lens of consumer harm. And the third is regulatory modernization. And among the things on regulatory modernization was the recognition during the pandemic of how archaic a lot of our rules are. And in particular, when it comes to state licensing and the like, they really just protect special interests. They serve no function for consumers. A lot of these licensing laws are just barriers to entry. But beyond that, they can really be pernicious. So, for example, a lot of states have laws that require in-person real estate closings, which was terrible during the pandemic. In-person appraisals of homes, having to get documents notarized. I mean, all these sort of crazy rules and regulations that just drive up costs and, you know, transfer rents to particular licensed professionals. We think it's that the states at least should take a close look at that, think about what impact this has on competition and innovation and driving up the cost to consumers, and licensing laws that seem to serve no function except to protect incumbents from competition are at the top of the list of things that should be scrutinized closely.
Thanks for that, Todd. Many critics of the task force, reading about things that were being said about it before the report came out, certainly, expected the report to be very pro-industry rather than pro-consumer. I must say, for my part, and it's not just because you're Cato Senior Fellow, that the report didn't seem so to me, but there are a couple of recommendations I think that might be perceived as tilting things in favor of industry. One of the ones that struck me that certainly might seem to do that to others is that the recommendation that Congress amend the Fair Credit Reporting Act to limit monetary awards in successful class action suits against financial firms. So how's that supposed to help consumers? You're saying that the financial firms will not have to face big penalties from these suits. How's that going to help consumers?
A great question, George, and I appreciate your introductory remarks saying that that you think that that description is inaccurate. And we felt like that also, as we talked about at the beginning, we show our homework. If people disagree with us, they can at least see transparently how we ended up reaching our conclusions. Our focus on consumer harm is another area in which I don't know if people focused on that as much, but think about these big thickets of regulation of disclosure that you get. Industry likes those big thickets of disclosure that nobody reads, right? It's like the pop-ups you get when you go to a website. Nobody reads the cookie policy. They just click on it, and it's a pretense of actually consenting. And we think that that's silly to think that giving people gigantic stacks of documents, expecting them to read them. Maybe that helps industry get protected from lawsuits down the road, but it doesn't seem like a sensible consumer protection policy. So we focus on consumer harm. And that's partly what leads us into the limits on class actions, which is we elsewhere in the report say that the enforcement policy should be focused on the actual harm to consumers more than sort of just running up damages or just figuring out how much the company could pay or whatever. You should try to calibrate it to consumer harm. This is a standard rule of law in economics in terms of optimal deterrence. With respect to the particular thing involving credit reporting agencies, that was one of the first statutes that was written. We suggest that really there's no other statute that gives you sort of unlimited liability, but the bet the company liabilities we talk about there. And it's just an outlier. And nobody's given an explanation for why that particular that particular statute should have essentially unlimited damages for somebody, whereas other statutes try to calibrate it to some extent to consumer harm. And so this is one of the things we put in to basically say, if there's a reason why that this should be so much larger than everything else, then tell us why. Because otherwise, it you know, there's a problem. But there's a problem of over-deterrence, which is that if you discourage people from sharing information, if you cause over-deterrence with respect to how people collect information alike, that results in increased cost. And those increased costs eventually result in increased cost to consumers that gets passed on in the form of higher cost and less access to credit. And so getting the damages right, we think, is really important. And maybe those are the right damages, but it's not the way we've done it in any other consumer financial legislation. So we say you should take another look at that and think about whether or not that rule still makes sense.
I see. So part of the problem is that these suits, if they impose very high penalties, those costs can sometimes be passed on to other consumers. Is that that's part of what you're saying, I take it?
That's exactly right, George, which is you can think of consumer financial protection through, we talk about a type one, type two error approach, like you see in antitrust and other places, which is that if you make liability too vague or too large, that will cause adjustments by issuers, by lenders. They're going to be less likely to lend to risky borrowers, and they're going to increase prices to everybody. And so over deterrence can be as big of a problem as under deterrence. And we say you should basically step back and think about what optimal deterrence and optimal remedies are, adjusted by the fact of all the different factors, including the actual harm plus the likelihood of getting caught and the like.
Let's return to the question of financial inclusion. This is certainly one of the biggest perceived problems in consumer finance today, and it seems likely to get quite a lot of attention from the Biden administration. And I want to particularly talk about the question of a lack of the unbanked, those who don't have bank accounts at all because they find having them too burdensome. Now, some are calling on the Fed to supply such people with low-cost retail accounts, that is, accounts at the Fed itself, which would be quite an innovation. The task force instead recommends that the Fed, quote, speed up the payments clearance system by updating Regulation CC on expedited funds on expedited funds availability as an appropriate step to reflect improvements in the check technology for faster check clearing. Now, I must say, if it's a choice between give people Fed accounts and doing this, give Fed accounts to people is going to win by being a lot easier to say. So maybe you could tell us a little bit more about this alternative, spell it out in plain English, starting with what regulation CC is, and then how updating that regulation would improve things, would improve a poor person's access to banking services.
Yeah, a great question. Thank you for that, George. And I will say your work on this has been in terms of thinking about faster payments and the work you've done on that is very important stuff. And as you know, it's cited in the report. This problem, and I agree with you, and I hope that financial inclusion is a high priority of the Biden administration, because I think it really is a moral imperative to increase access to the financial system for everybody, and have a financial system that works for everybody, because this is energy, right? Access to financial products and services is necessary for the world to go around. And we address this in two ways in the report. The first is we look at eliminating current barriers to mainly regulatory, but perhaps other economic, but eliminating barriers that prevent lenders and industry from providing financial services to consumers. So things like the Durbin Amendment, which proved devastating, which placed price controls on interchange fees that got passed through to consumers and reduced access to free checking and higher checking accounts. That's been horrible for low-income consumers who can't meet higher minimum balance requirements. Talk a lot about the Credit Card Act and the way in which Credit Card Act regulations limit access to younger consumers, for example, or interfere with risk, the ability to price risk effectively. The way that is cut off access to credit cards, and when the supply of products goes away, that doesn't eliminate the demand. And so we say, at least maybe you don't agree that we should get rid of those or whatever or amend them, but you should at least take account of the fact that there are costs, unintended consequences of those, and eliminate those. And we think that the great success in the American financial system has been eliminating regulatory barriers, most notably usury restrictions. The second thing that we talk about is facilitating access and things that could increase access. And one of the big choke points, I think the report indicates, to greater financial inclusion right now is the center of bank accounts in the economy, which is this sort of binary distinction as to whether you're banked or unbanked, depending on whether or not you have a bank account. And that just doesn't seem to be useful anymore. And it doesn't seem to be the way that a lot of consumers bank, which is consumers, it's much more of a continuum now. People unbundle bank accounts and get, through fintech. They use Venmo. They use all these different sorts of products and in services. And one of the things we say, for example, is we should explore allowing non-banks access to the payment systems and the payment clearance system and what that might look like. And while there are obviously risks to that, we think that could be very helpful in increasing financial access to the payment system and increasing innovation in payments and convenience for consumers. What you're referring to is a problem which has been sort of repeatedly pointed to, including by you yourself, George, which is the lag period, the latency period between the time when you try to deposit a check and it's actually put into your account. And one of the recommendations we have is to do research on how much use of things like payday loans and the like is caused by the fact that it might take 2 or 3 days for somebody's paycheck to clear. The whole, one of the things we point out is that even people who have bank accounts use check cashers in a remarkably high rate simply because they need the money sooner. They can't you know, put the money, deposit the money on Friday and not get access until Monday. And so what we are saying, and other countries have managed to figure this out, how to create a faster a payment system. And we are saying basically, look at our regulatory structure, including Reg CC, and figure out the extent to which that is causing a logjam here, causing people to use alternative financial providers and the like, and figure out how to balance the legitimate concerns about fraud with people being able to get access to their money quicker. And that's sort of what that whole recommendation is about.
Just have a couple more minutes left, and I find myself challenged to decide which of the other questions I had for you I should ask. Let's see if we can't get two in with relatively short responses. You say that the report says, I should say, the report calls the CFPB's current enforcement practices opaque. Pardon me, I lost an earbud. Wouldn't want to do that. Okay. Now I can hear both sides of things. The report also recommends, quote, that consumer harm should be the lodestar of every enforcement decision. That seems to be a kind of pretty strong implied criticism of the Bureau that's, after all, charged with consumer financial protection. So if they're not basing their enforcement practices on harm done to consumers, what are they basing them on? How do you propose to change that?
Well, there's two questions there, which is first is transparency, and the second is what should they base it on. And on the transparency point, the other federal regulators have adopted matrices as to how they're going to impose penalties and become more predictable. One of the concerns we heard with the CFPB is that it's not clear what they're going to pursue, what their enforcement priorities are going to be, and what the damages are likely to be. And oftentimes, it's through this negotiating process where people suggest that the CFPB starts off not necessarily with how much consumers have harmed, but how much they think the company could pay. And then they work backwards from there. And yes. So what we say is it would be good to adopt a civil penalty matrix like the other bank regulators have, so that you can identify what the biggest issues are. You could take you could take precautions and take appropriate precautions for the risks and highlight the things that you're most concerned about. We also suggest that the CFPB should adopt something that we call enforcement highlights. And what that would do would be a way of not only saying what they've been doing, but also what they haven't been doing. One of the things that that the CFPB doesn't have a good way of communicating right now are what are the things that they have looked at and turn out to be okay. You only find out when they've sued somebody, not when they've looked at something and haven't sued somebody. With respect to consumer harm, then it comes back to the same basic idea, which is that the focus should be the focus should be on remediating consumer harm, adjusted by the probability of getting caught. And again, the idea here is to take optimal enforcement policy so that you are that the lenders and providers are allocating their risk reduction, their internal compliance rules and the like to their highest valued use, which is making sure that they are in compliance with the things the CFPB cares most about, taking precautions where appropriate, but not taking over precautions and the like that can be expensive and end up reducing access to credit and raising costs.
Thanks, Todd. We have a few questions now that have come in from various listeners, and so I'd like to turn the floor to them by posing some of their questions to you, Todd. The first one comes from Jane on Twitter, and she asks, what do you see as the biggest barrier to alternative data being used in the mainstream? In mainstream, I take it mainstream financial industry?
Yeah, thank you for that question, Jane. And there's really two concerns that we became aware of. The first is just simply regulatory, which is that we heard from certain parties that there was regulatory uncertainty, and then there's a concern that parties have about what their liability might be if they were considered to be furnishers of information related to credit. There are questions, for example, involving cell phones and cell phone payments, where the ability to, whether you're paying your cell phone bill, the ability to be able to provide that information by cell phone companies, it was unclear how the privacy regulations intersect with this benefit. And that's a lot of what the problem we run into here is we have a relatively highly encrusted and a difficult privacy system that's been built up in the United States. I think a lot of people, for example, pointed to the HIPAA rules involving medical privacy, where obviously it's designed to serve a certain function, which it does well, but also can be a barrier to people getting better healthcare because of limits on the ability of healthcare providers to be able to share information easily about your medical condition. And so I think one of the things that we became aware of is there's a little bit of a balkanized regulatory view as to what is the ability of utility providers, what is the ability of cell phone providers. A lot of these potential people who could rent is another one. A lot of these people who could furnish useful information aren't clear whether what the regulatory framework is that governs them. And it's all voluntary, right? Our credit reporting system here in the United States is voluntary. And so if you run any risk or any cost of or any risk of liability, you're not likely to do it. The second thing is social, which is attitudes towards privacy are very much in flux. And people's views on that are changing. And one of the problems is that people who are making privacy policy aren't usually 25-year-olds or 30-year-olds. They're 60-year-olds or they're heads of organizations and the like. And so one of the things we say is, let's keep the system flexible so that as people's attitudes towards this change over time, what is acceptable and what's unacceptable, that they should be allowed to do it. And so those, I think, are the largest barriers at this point, are regulatory and social.
We have a question from Slido. The person isn't identified. Let's see if I can find it. There were several, actually. Ah, yes. The questioner asks, since there were no consumer representatives on the task force, did the task force consult and receive input and views from such representatives?
Absolutely. And thank you for that question, because, it was one of these things where it was challenging. We were on a very strict deadline of year. And obviously, the pandemic made it much more challenging. We literally were in the CFPB building meeting for an in-person meeting the day it closed in March because of the pandemic. And we had laid out a very aggressive slate of meetings and listening sessions, and we did one that week before we shut down. And so that kind of set us back a little bit, but we were very determined to get this input. So we did a number of things, which is, number one, we did a request for information, and we're very gratified. A lot of people provide a lot of good information about issues we should be looking at and the like. We also had our staff, and I want to thank our staff, who was brilliant and incredibly dedicated during this, to go out and do what we call a public research examination, which is to go out and look at what a lot of stakeholders were saying, especially consumer so-called consumer groups, and what they were doing. And then once we kind of got our sea legs, we did a series of listening sessions online. We did a hearing with academic fintech experts, including Mirza Baradarin, Marcus Cole, Vicky Bogan, and Vernon Smith. And so we did all that we could to get as much input as we could, especially given the challenges of the pandemic. And we were gratified with the cooperation we got. And so we got a lot of that. We got a lot of direct background. We consulted with, I think, 15 or so other agencies in the federal and state government, and we got a lot of input. And I want to thank especially the CFPB staff for how helpful they were in answering our questions, providing information, and providing input to us. So we tried to cast as wide a net as we possibly could to try to get all the perspectives we could.
Thanks, Todd. There's another Slido question, and let me see if I can provide. Put my fingers on it. This one is from Victoria, and she wonders whether there isn't also a problem with fees that are provided in class action suits to the plaintiff's attorneys, and whether these aren't disproportional to the actual rewards, settlement amounts provided to the consumers. And I think this is a good question, since the goal is to base enforcement on harm. One would think that making the consumers whole is very important. If you're limiting these the amounts that can be settled upon, and then too much of that goes to lawyers, the consumers end up perhaps not being made whole at all. What was the task force, what thought has the task force given to this problem?
Well, thank you for that question, Victoria, and that gives me an opportunity to probably say something I had a chance to mention, which is we wrote 900 pages. We covered yet we didn't cover everything, believe it or not. And we, as we lay out at the beginning of the report, we had a three-part test for things that we did not address. So for example, there's very little in the report on mortgages and mortgage servicing and the like. And everybody knows that mortgages are important. Everybody knows that was, huge involving the financial crisis and in everything else. So, but yet we don't touch very much on the mortgage market. Why is that? Well, we had sort of three factors that we considered, which is first, is something important, and obviously that would be important. But second, has the CFPB already looked at it such that there's something that we feel like we could add? And third, is there something that our particular task force had as a comparative advantage to be able to weigh in on? Was it something that was within our rubric? And is it something that we felt like we had something uniquely valuable to speak to? And so if you look at mortgage servicing in mortgages, for example, CFPB has had a huge amount of activity and regulations in retrospect review in that area. Obviously, Mark Calabria over at FHFA knows more about this topic than probably everybody on this call put together. And so that was an area that there's a lot going on. There's a very rich body of research. And we didn't think that by and large, we had a lot to say that was useful to add to the GSE patch, for example. We talk about some odds and ends of things that we think are useful from a consumer perspective, but that debt collection might be another example of something where the CFPB has done a lot of work. And so your point is a good one. It's a good question. It's obviously an important question and would go to consumer harm, but it's not something that that we addressed here as something where we felt like it was particularly within the scope of what the director asked us to report on, and directly something that we thought that we had a particularly unique expertise to be able to contribute something meaningful for.
Well, I hope if there's some agency out there that is capable of making lawyers cost less, that they get to it. Peter on Slido, I'm sorry, I've got quite a horse in my, I have a frog in my throat. Peter on Slido asks how you expect digital currencies to change the financial landscape. And I suppose that question might refer either to private digital currencies or to the possibility of central bank supplied digital currencies. So perhaps you could say something briefly about each of those things, Todd.
That's a great question, and I would refer you for detailed discussion to Chapter 9 of Volume 1 of our report, which is on innovation. And we were the task force is big believers in the role of innovation in improving competition, consumer choice, and particularly financial inclusion, and that includes digital currencies and the like. Which is, I see Alex further down asked about, does the report address faster payments? Said the Fed has moved on this, and we do, and we encourage faster payments. And again, George has written some really excellent work on this, and it's kind of inexplicable how long it has taken. In my view, for us to get to a faster payment system, or when it's been done elsewhere in the world. But there's a little bit of a sense in which faster payments, while very helpful, is kind of like, I analogize it in my head to sort of making the landline telephone system better and regular land-based phone calls clearer. And the response is, well, what about cell phones? And that's the way I think about the question of access to digital currencies and like for consumers, which is, I think, as I was saying earlier, bank accounts are a real choke point for people to get access to the financial system. The big full-service bank account like we have today is not obviously the best system for people, where you bundle together a transactional account with sort of payments with access to loans and interest and all that sort of thing. There's no reason those two things have to be bundled together. There's historical reasons why that might be. But today, people are disaggregating their financial services and using a lot of different providers for different services, from lending to payments and the like, and one payment platform on top of another. And I think that digital currencies are a way forward with respect to that, as a way of sort of end running bank accounts. Bank accounts are still going to be there, are going to be useful for a lot of people, but I think more and more people are comfortable with that. And again, one of the things that's interesting about during the pandemic is transitions that people thought might take 10 years took 5 or 10 months. The world is accelerating, and it's accelerating at an accelerating pace. And transitions to perhaps online banking that people have, using their phones for banking and the like, we've seen how quickly that necessity is the mother of invention. And you think people who would never use those type of devices have been using them in the past year. Contactless payments have taken off, right? Online banking, all these sorts of things. And so I think digital currencies is probably the next thing, and in particular things like stable coins, things like that, that can be used as a mechanism for people to come up with a better, faster, more secure payments transactions, I think is the next frontier for consumers, and in particular for lower income consumers. And we, to the extent that we've seen this in the rest of the world, in places like M-Pesa and things like that, show the way in which people with a phone can be empowered to be able to do things that you would never have thought in the past.
You know, people often think of payments in terms of either old-fashioned bank accounts or blockchain-based digital currency. There's a lot of stuff in between, and one option that your report refers to, at least briefly, is stored value cards, which are an important form of payments device that is important, particularly for the unbanked, that many of the unbanked use as an alternative to having bank accounts. So I just wanted to throw that out, because they tend to fall under the radar, but they're actually much more widely used than people realize, and they can offer a lot of banking services to people who don't have bank accounts. Some people think that they are the real option that needs to be advanced. We had a question from Alex on Slido about faster payments, but really asking about what the task force has had to say about them. But I think you've kind of addressed that. So, Alex, I hope you don't mind. I'm going to move on to some others. Here's a question from Nick on Slido. Slido's getting the most action here. There's a section in the report, Nick says, devoted to modernizing rules around e-signatures. And indeed, there is, and I skipped that. I had a question, but I didn't have time for it. So thank you, Nick. Did the pandemic influence the report's findings and recommendations about these rules? Tell us what the report does recommend about e-signatures, Todd, and then tell us whether the pandemic was behind that recommendation.
Yeah, and basically what we say in so many words is the e-signature rules were more or less obsolete the moment that they the ink dried on the e-signature rules. And basically what we're saying is that Congress replace or revise substantially the e-sign act to remove in things like antiquated requirements, required disclosures of hardware and software and all these sorts of things. People consume information on their phones now. They're not going to take documents, print them out, review them, do all these sorts of things that e-sign suggests. And so it's just kind of an antiquated rule. There's been ways that, UEDA is a workaround that the states have come up with. But e-sign's just kind of, friction in the gears right now. And the pandemic did. This was something, obviously, that was something we would have been interested in. But the pandemic really highlighted it. The pandemic really highlighted a lot of some of the more archaic aspects of the financial regulatory system, which is based on this old idea of big stacks of paper and in-person type processes. I referred earlier to states that require in-person real estate closings and wet signatures and documents and notaries. And you just think of what a hassle it is to conduct a lot of financial transactions in a world in which people consume information on their phones. They're not printing things out. They're checking boxes and, in the like, and e-sign just doesn't fit with that. But e-sign, I think, is a case study of a larger concern that we had, which is to create a regulatory system that was more flexible, that could expand over time. As I said a moment ago, the world is accelerating at an accelerating rate. It's speeding up. Technology is changing so quickly. Consumer preferences are changing so quickly. The way consumers use financial products are changing so quickly. And we have a system that's kind of encrusted in a 1970s mindset, and it worked pretty well for many decades. But it's a system based on paper. It's a system based on these long, detailed, prescriptive disclosures. And it just doesn't really work anymore. And so we had a general theme in the report of moving towards more principles-based regulation rather than rules-based regulation in order to provide that flexibility. We talk about the need to come up with more formal ways of dealing with emergency situations, such as the pandemic, and the ability to kind of to respond to that in a coherent way. The financial regulators, I think, did a pretty fabulous job of kind of responding on the fly, given the powers that they had to the pandemic, but creating a more formalized process for responding to crises like that. We've had three crises in the last 20 years between 9/11, the 2008 financial crisis, and the pandemic, and I don't think anybody thinks those are going to go away. And so that's the other thing I think e-sign is a good example of, is don't take a snapshot in time, put it in legislation. Think about creating a more flexible way that will protect consumers while at the same time allow that system to adapt as technology and consumer preferences change.
We have time for at least one more question. And we have one here from Tom on Slido. And Tom is a Cato sponsor, so pay close attention. Tom asks, can you name some significant regulations that need to be reduced? I suppose pick your top three or something like that, Todd. And also, can you address the broader question of how easy it is to reduce regulations in this field, in the financial realm, as opposed to adding new regulations? Are you fighting an uphill battle when you want to get rid of some regulation? Compared to proposing something new? Those are the two.
Yeah, questions. great questions, Tom. Thank you for that. And I want to start with the second one, which will then frame the first question, which is one of the strong views that we express in this report is that it is time to move beyond the idea of regulation as a zero-sum game. And this is generally a problem, but it's especially a problem of financial regulation, which is a tendency to think of more regulation as good for consumers and less regulation as better for industry. Regulation versus deregulation. I don't know that we use the term deregulation in the entire report. And the reason is it's not just rhetorical, it's conceptual, which is a good system of regulation should not be zero sum, it should be positive sum. Good regulation is good for consumers, industry, and the overall economy. And so we give the example of debt collection. Good, sound debt collection rules are fair to consumers and give them confidence to borrow. And it's fair to legitimate lenders who do legitimate collection practices that are not oppressive to consumers. And where consumers feel like they're being treated, that there's a fair and efficient system, consumers will borrow more, they will consume more, they will use more financial products. That's a good example that is subject to good, sound, rigorous cost-benefit analysis of something that's a positive sum. And that is what animated us through this report, is trying to think about a regulatory framework that protects consumers and empowers consumers and improves consumer welfare across the board by increasing choice, reducing prices, increasing innovation, while at the same time protecting consumers from harm. And that was our goal. And so we usually use, for example, we talk about amending regulations, studying regulations to reduce their unintended consequences, and making regulation work better. But I think that's the biggest obstacle in terms of the ease of reducing regulation versus adding it, is that we need a better conceptual framework for thinking about regulation and get beyond this zero-sum regulation versus deregulation type thing. And so there's a number of places. We actually suggest some places where maybe new regulation might be possible. So we say, for example, maybe Congress should consider looking at ECOA. Societal norms have changed, and disability, for example, is not under ECOA. Maybe Congress should consider disability should be protected under ECOA. We talk about other things in ECOA that are just modernized. So, for example, there's a whole market now in which people can borrow money for assisted fertility treatments, which are very expensive. Yet ECOA says you can't ask somebody what their childbearing plans are, right? That's a kind of an obsolete concern that maybe had some credence in the 70s, but nowadays asking somebody if they're borrowing money in order to engage in assisted reproductive technology, it's just, that's just kind of regulatory brain deadness at this point, right? That you need a way of kind of updating rules and regulations as things change. We also point to things, as I said, like repealing the Durbin Amendment, amending the Credit Card Act, and some of the other things where where it's clear that there are unintended consequences and costs to consumers, and maybe somebody might disagree with the weighting of the cost and benefits. But at least it's worth considering what are those unintended consequences and costs, and think about whether there's a better way to get from here to there and achieve your consumer protection goals at lower cost to consumers. And so I think good, solid, rigorous analysis is the way in which you get regulatory reform.
Thanks, Todd. We are just have a couple minutes left. So we have a question from Andy that asks whether the report addresses identity theft that arises from payment systems and check systems. Todd, if you can answer that in less than 1 minute, we have 1 minute, a quick answer, and then I'm afraid we're going to have to end the program.
Well, thanks. That is not something we talk about in detail. We do raise concerns about data privacy and data security, but that is not an issue that we talk about. Although there, I will add one last thought that this question of formerly incarcerated populations, it appears identity theft is a very big problem for people who are in prison because of their inability to check what's going on with their lives, basically. And so that is one area in which we talk about identity theft very strongly. And we also talk about the unintended consequences of things like the GDPR and their potential to actually increase identity theft under the guise of actually protecting people.
Thanks, Todd. Thanks for your generous time this morning. I really appreciate your giving us the opportunity to have you talk about the task force report. I also want to thank our audience for being here, but also for their very good questions, terrific questions. I hope you've all enjoyed it. And please keep track of our other activities. We'll have more in the future. We'd love to have you all back. So thank you all very much. Bye-bye.